Hello, and welcome to our program, Senior Living, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Chrissy Mernon. During this next half hour, I'm reading articles from the AARP Bulletin here on OWL Radio. And the first one is Your Life, Unsung Heroes of the Civil Rights Movement, along with legendary champions thousands sacrificed during the era of change. Here are a few of their stories by A.J. Baim. Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, Medgar Evers, John Lewis. These names ring through history as leaders of the vast sprawling events that constituted the civil rights movement in which African Americans struggled for equality during the 1950s, 1960s, and beyond. But the movement could not have succeeded without thousands of people of all races making important, if often overlooked, contributions, and without millions of people moved by their efforts deciding that it was time to do the right thing. For Black History Month, we went in search of those men and women who did their part to change the history of America without seeking fame or reward, simply because they saw the need to become part of the solution. Here are their stories. Willie Pearl Mackie King on the Birmingham jail letter. 82, living in Montgomery County, Maryland, King worked from 1962 to 1966 as a member of Martin Luther King Jr.'s executive staff. Where I lived in Atlanta in 1962, the landlady rented her extra bedrooms to college students and working young ladies. Dorothy Cotton lived on the first floor. Cotton is known as a pillar of the civil rights movement. One day, she asked if I was looking for work. I had never worked in an office. Dorothy gave me an address and said, "You should go here and apply." That is how I got hired at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They put me at the reception desk, and I started reading brochures about this place where I was working. I had never heard of civil rights before. Then one day, this gentleman came in and greeted me, asking me about my church and my family. I realized this was the man in the brochures. He was in charge of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and his name was Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King asked me if I would go with him on certain trips. I was elated. In December of 1962, I went with Dr. King to Birmingham to organize a people-to-people tour of the state of Alabama. We visited towns all over the state, and this is how the Birmingham movement got started. This was to be nonviolent protest in the heart of Jim Crow. The FBI told Dr. King, "There are credible threats against your life. We cannot guarantee your safety." Well, Dr. King called us together. He said, "If you decide you don't want to go on this trip, that it's too dangerous, I will not be offended, because we could be killed." I looked around thinking it would be canceled, but no one else said no. I went off and did my crying, and then I came back and said, "I'm going." On Good Friday in 1962, after the protest in Birmingham began, Dr. King was arrested. A group of eight ministers wrote an article, A Call to Unity, saying Dr. King was an outsider and urging locals not to participate in what he was doing. Dr. King decided that he was going to write an answer. He was in jail, and he asked the jailers for pen and paper. They said, "You're not in a library. You don't get anything to write with." He wrote on the edges of newspaper, on toilet paper, on sandwich bags. His attorney, Clarence Jones, hid the scraps under his suit jacket and slipped them out of the jail. We had to put together this jigsaw puzzle. We were on the floor trying to figure it out, scotch taping things together. Dr. King's handwriting was not the best. The lighting was terrible in his jail cell. That is how we developed the letter from Birmingham Jail. When we released it, no one paid attention at first. Only when Bull Connor, the city's commissioner of public safety, ordered fire hoses and dogs onto the demonstrators in Birmingham's Kelly Ingram Park did we start getting requests for the letter from Birmingham Jail. I could not mimeograph enough copies. The letter became one of the most important documents of the civil rights era. If people read that letter today, they will understand what Dr. King was doing in Birmingham and why he was fighting so hard for civil rights. In my opinion, none of his speeches or writings will give you a clearer vision of his mission. My whole career was helping people. That was instilled in me by Dr. King and others that I worked with so closely. I can't think of a better way to spend a life than helping people. Charles Person on the Freedom Riders, 81, living in Atlanta. Civil rights activist, the youngest member of the original Freedom Riders, later a Vietnam veteran and the author of Buses Are A-Comin'. My dad was a patriotic veteran of the Second World War. He was optimistic that change would come for black people. This is our country, too. That's what my dad preached. My journey began when, as a high school senior in Atlanta, I applied to Morehouse College in Atlanta and was accepted. When I got to campus in 1960, the sit-in movement was beginning. I was there every day. The idea was to enter a restaurant, sit at the counter, and shut the restaurant down, because we knew, as black people, we wouldn't be served. Ultimately, I was arrested with others. In 1961, the Congress of Racial Equality organized the first Freedom Ride. The idea was to challenge the non-enforcement of the Supreme Court decisions that ruled that segregation on interstate buses and in bus terminals was unconstitutional. The southern states were ignoring these decisions. Our goal was to ride the bus south and sit where they said we couldn't. This was not civil disobedience. This was law on our side. I was 18 and needed a parent's signature. Dad approved. Mom was reluctant. But I went. The first Freedom Ride bus left Washington, D.C. on May 4, 1961. Aboard was a mix of black and white activists, including future Congressman John Lewis. I was the youngest Freedom Rider on that first trip. We were well-groomed because how we presented ourselves was important. Each night, we stayed with members of congregations who fed us. We switched buses each day for safety. We were ordinary people trying to do things to make our lives extraordinary. People taunted us all the way to Alabama. When we got to Anniston, a group of men boarded the bus and came toward us. That is when the beating started. In Birmingham, the next stop, a mob was waiting when we exited the bus. My fellow Freedom Rider, James Peck, went down almost immediately. I maintained my balance but had my scalp opened. I got away from the crowds, and as luck would have it, a city bus came by. I got on, and the driver had sympathy. He took me to a safe place. He said, "If you go across the tracks, there will be someone there to help you." I ended up in a church where a nurse put a bandage on my head that pulled my scalp together. The beatings made national news as a pivotal event in the civil rights struggle. Using photographs, the FBI identified the men who beat us. I thought it was a slam-dunk case, but there was no way an all-white jury in the South would convict white men for beating up a black person. I made the entire ride to New Orleans, and when I got back to Atlanta, my mom thought I'd be killed if I stayed in the civil rights movement. Like my father, I chose to serve. I entered the Marine Corps and went to Vietnam. I was exposed to Agent Orange and have cancer today. Whenever I have the chance to speak to young people, I tell them they can change the world. I hope they listen to anyone who tells them they have the power to make the world a better place. Fred Gray on the Montgomery bus protest, 93, living in Tuskegee, Alabama. A preacher and a civil rights attorney who argued some of the most important cases regarding race in American history. When I was growing up, there were two professions a black man could take up, a preacher or a teacher. I studied to become a preacher in Nashville, Tennessee, and when I returned to my home state of Alabama, I enrolled at the Alabama State College for Negroes, now Alabama State University. There were serious problems with how black people were treated on the buses, including one man who had been killed. E.D. Nixon, a black leader and president of the local NAACP branch, told me they needed lawyers and didn't know any. So when I graduated college, I enrolled at Case Western Reserve, then Western Reserve University Law School in Cleveland, Ohio. I passed the Alabama and Ohio bar exams in the summer of 1954. 6 months later, on March 2, 1955, a 15-year-old girl named Claudette Colvin was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on a public bus to a white person. Claudette lived in an area in the northern part of Montgomery. there were two or three streets of black families surrounded by whites. The black school kids had to take two buses to get to Booker T. Washington High School. On the day Claudette was arrested, the students had been let out early from school because of a teacher's meeting. When they got downtown, a lot of white people were getting on the bus, and they asked Claudette to get up from her seat. She was not sitting in what was called the white section, and so she told the bus driver she was not going to get up. She was arrested, and I agreed to represent her in juvenile court. Claudette's was my first civil rights case. The judge was very polite, but he still found her a delinquent. 9 months later, Rosa Parks did the same thing. I had known Mrs. Parks from the time I was an undergraduate at Alabama State. When I opened my law office in late September of 1954 to the day of her arrest on December 1st, 1955, she would come to my office and talk about problems, about how even after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision in 1954, no schools in Alabama were desegregated. We had talked about how a person should conduct themselves if they were asked to give up a seat on a bus. I had gotten the impression that if the opportunity presented itself, she would not give up her seat, which is what she did. She retained me to represent her. I met with Edgar Nixon of the NAACP and Joanne Robinson, an instructor at Alabama State University, who was the president of the Women's Political Council, an organization in Montgomery to help blacks get registered to vote and to generally improve conditions. At her house, we planned the Montgomery bus boycott. Black people stopped riding buses, threatening to financially cripple the city's transportation system. Joanne Robinson said, "We will need a spokesman. My pastor, Martin Luther King, hasn't been here in Montgomery long, but he can move people with words. We can get him to be the spokesman." I had never met Dr. King. Few knew who he was at that time. He was selected to be the spokesman and I to do the legal work. We held a meeting at Holt Street Baptist Church. When the people heard Dr. King speak, we were convinced that important things were about to happen. And when the buses rolled on Monday morning, very few blacks were on them. Dr. King and I were in contact almost on a day-to-day basis for the 382 days of the bus boycott. Only we did not call it a boycott because it wasn't a boycott. We called it a protest. During that time, the world came to know his name. 3 months after the Montgomery bus protest began, Alabama indicted 89 persons. The prosecutors then decided that instead of trying 89 cases, they would select one, and of course, they selected Dr. King. I had the responsibility of getting a legal team together. We tried that case for 4 days. We were able to get black people to describe how they had been mistreated on the buses, including the wife of a man who had been killed. Notwithstanding, the judge found Dr. King guilty. For the rest of my life, I have fought to destroy everything segregated I could find. I have fought for education rights, for black voting rights. Inequality and the struggle for equal justice continues. I am 93 years old and still fighting. The next article from AARP Bulletin is Your Health, New Gains in Brain Pain. Migraine symptoms change with age, but new advancement in treatment are making the condition more manageable than ever, by Jessica Magala. It's an exciting time to have a migraine. Okay, maybe not really, but if you struggled over the years with this unique breed of brain pain, as opposed to the more common and muscle-based tension headache, relief may finally be in sight. To have a migraine brain is to have a highly reactive brain that does not respond well to changes in light, temperature, sound, or even smell. Anything that triggers this increased sensitivity can cause your brain to start zipping off pain signals. The headaches can last up to 72 hours, but the full duration of an attack may be a week. For some, there is no headache at all, but other symptoms, flashes of light or bright spots, loss of sight, nausea, numbness, or tingling, can mimic alarming ER-worthy conditions. In other words, don't think of a migraine as a simple headache. It's a genetic neurologic disease, says Nina Riggins, MD, neurologist, headache specialist, and president of the Brain Performance Center and Research Institute. There's been a sea change as to how we speak about migraine. Someone doesn't have migraines, they experience migraine, an important distinction that speaks to the disruptive and disabling nature of this disease. At its heart, migraine may be the product of a more sensitized nervous system, though researchers are still trying to unfold the exact cause. We think the central nervous system of migraine patients is more sensitive to lifestyle disruptions, says Catherine Carroll, MD, a neurologist with the Northwestern Medicine Comprehensive Headache Center in Chicago. How migraine changes with age. 1 in 10 older adults experience migraine every year, according to research in the journal Neurology and Neuroscience. Symptoms evolve with age, especially for women after menopause, as the monthly rise and fall of hormones is a common trigger. Women are 2 to 3 times more likely to experience migraines than men. The headache, which in younger people often manifests as a pulsating ache on one side of the head, may shift to both sides of the head as a person ages, Riggins says. Older people are also less likely to be light and sound sensitive or to have other traditional migraine symptoms such as nausea and vomiting. As people, particularly females, get older and hormones change after menopause, they may drop the headache altogether and their migraine may be aura only, says Barbara L. Nye, MD, clinical associate professor in neurology at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. Aura refers to visual changes, flashes, bright spots, shapes, blind spots, or blurred or lost vision that typically precede a headache. You may be driving down your street and see a shimmer in your vision or partially blocked vision, Nye says. Imagine the panic, since these can also be signs of a stroke. More than half of those with migraines say they're constantly juggling treatments in search of the right one, according to 2021 data from the National Headache Foundation. Over the past 5 years, however, new therapies have emerged that are changing the way migraine is managed. Historically, the only therapies available were medications used for other diseases such as seizure disorder, depression, or high blood pressure, Nye says. Though these remain viable and effective options, some are not safe for older adults with conditions such as heart disease. So it's a relief that a number of new therapies, including drugs and devices, have been designed specifically to prevent and treat migraine, and many have proven to be better suited for older adults. Oral medications. The new generation of migraine drugs is called CGRP antagonist, or GPANTS. These drugs, rimegepant, Nurtec, ergogepant, Ubrelvy, and ottogepant, Qulipta, block the action of a pathway or connection of brain cells involved in triggering migraine attacks. Typically, these are used as needed to treat a migraine in progress, but the Food and Drug Administration expanded the approval of Qulipta, allowing it to be used as a daily preventative for people who experience at least 15 headache days a month, called chronic migraine. Clinical trials on this group found that 41% of patients experienced at least a 50% reduction in their headache days every month when given 1 of 3 dosage levels, compared with 29% of those taking a placebo. GPANTS are an especially useful alternative for people who don't respond to triptans, a more traditional migraine medication, and a safer type of drug for those with heart disease, a 2022 review suggests. Nasal spray, zavegepant, Zavspret, a GPANT nasal spray used to treat migraine, can bring relief within 30 minutes. Approved by the FDA last year and launched over the summer, the spray provides a quicker onset of action compared to oral rescue medications, which is good for patients whose migraines come on fast and severe, Carroll says. If you experience nausea and vomiting, this is a good option should you have trouble keeping down a pill. Injectables. Galkanezumab, Emgality, Arenumab, Amovig, and Fremanezumab, Ajovy, are self-injected drugs called CGRP monoclonal antibodies that prevent the onset of an attack by blocking the migraine pathway. We are using these for prevention, and they don't usually interact with other medications, Regan says. Neuromodulation. These wearable devices, five are FDA cleared, Cephali, Savi, Gammacor, Relivion, and Nerivio, stimulate nerves to help regulate nervous system function, which decreases migraine. These can be an excellent tool to prevent and treat migraine. They're considered safe devices, and many of my patients find them relaxing to use, Nye says, although they can't be used by people with pacemakers. Regan says people often have to use both medication and neuromodulation, but these devices can cut down on the amount of meds they need to take. Green light. Whereas blue light is agitating to the migraine brain, green light is considered to be brain-friendly. A small study in the journal Cephalalgia showed that green light exposure for 1 to 2 hours per day decreased headache days from 7.9 per month to 2.4 per month on average. In those with chronic migraine, the green light cut headache days by more than half, according to the study. Green light may act on cells in your retina that alter your perception of pain. The Allay lamp is a green light lamp developed by Harvard Medical School neuroscientist Rami Burstein specifically for migraine control. Other options include Gamma's Soothe lamp, as well as green light bulbs from Huga or Norb. When to see a doctor. Head pain is an indication from your body saying something isn't right, says neurologist Barbara L. Nye, MD. If you develop headaches, they've just started, are more prevalent, or come with different symptoms than before, that's a sign that you should talk to your doctor for a workup to check out what may be going on, she says. Head pain in older adults can be a sign of an underlying health condition such as sleep apnea or medication interactions. If you're suddenly struck with the worst headache of your life or experience weakness, numbness, or a change in vision that comes on quickly, seek emergency care. These can be signs of a brain aneurysm or stroke. The next article from AARP Bulletin is in the news. Lung cancer guidelines changed for ex-smokers. If you ever smoked and are age 50 to 80, you should have a yearly lung cancer screening, even if you last lit up decades ago. Recommendations by the American Cancer Society issued late last year say anyone who smoked a pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years needs to get an annual lung CT scan, no matter how long ago they quit. ACS guidelines previously said that those who quit 15 or more years ago were in the clear. Robert Smith, ACS Senior Vice President, said in a news release that the change is based on new studies that showed expanding screening eligibility saved lives, even among people who quit smoking years earlier. Lung cancer can occur in anyone, but smoking is the top risk factor and is linked to 80% to 90% of lung cancer deaths. Most people diagnosed with the disease are 65 or older. The disease is often symptomless until it's at an advanced stage when it's harder to treat. Large-scale trials show that early detection can lead to a 20% to 25% improvement in survival rates, researchers say. A 2022 report from the American Lung Association found that only 5.8% of people eligible for lung cancer screening in the U.S. get screened. Medicare Part B will cover lung cancer screenings once a year for many people up to age 77 who smoke or quit in the past 15 years with an order from a doctor. Scams feared more than violent crime. More than twice as many Americans fear being the victim of a scam or having their identity stolen than fear being murdered, a Gallup poll reveals. This growing concern about fraud is understandable, experts say. The reported financial losses to scams have more than tripled during the pandemic and have reached an epidemic level, says Kathy Stokes, head of fraud prevention programs at AARP. In the November survey, 8% of people said they had been victimized by scams. 15% said someone in their household had been a victim. The study also showed 72% of respondents were afraid their identity would be stolen by hackers. 57% were afraid they'd be duped out of money in a scam. In comparison, 28% feared being murdered, 37% feared being mugged, and 44% feared being burglarized. New laws ban predatory real estate deals. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a state law that protects homeowners from what AARP and other consumer advocates call unfair real estate agreements, the latest step in a campaign to have the practice eliminated across America. The Golden State Law restricts homeowner benefit agreements in which a brokerage firm would offer a homeowner, usually an older person, a small amount of cash to sign an agreement that gave the firm the sole right for up to 40 years to list the home for sale if it ever went on the market. Homeowners who changed their minds could face a penalty of up to 3% of the property's value under the agreements. When the penalty wasn't paid, the firm could place a lien against the home, preventing its sale, and the deals could bind people who inherited the property. AARP and other consumer activists call the contracts unfair and, in some cases, little more than a scam. Canine comfort. Owning a dog lowered the risk of disability among 11,000 older Japanese adults who took part in a study published in the journal PLOS-1. Researchers attribute this partly to the dog owner's increased physical activity. Cat ownership, on the other hand, had no effect on disability risk. New IRS brackets could lower taxes for some. Inflation has hurt lots of people on fixed incomes, but it has also created a potential piece of good news. The money you make this year might be taxed a bit less, as federal tax brackets have been adjusted to reflect inflation. That could mean you may fall into a lower bracket, paying a smaller percentage of taxes on income. Another change, the standard deduction is $14,600 for single filers for the 2024 tax year, up from $13,850 for 2023. The standard deduction for couples filing jointly is $29,200 in 2024, up from $27,700. And more good news for older taxpayers, joint filers can increase the standard deduction by $1,550 apiece for a total of $3,100 if both joint filers are 65 plus. In total, a married couple 65 or older would have a standard deduction of $32,300. And the last article from AARP Bulletin is Medicare Made Easy by Dina Bunis. Are there any changes to Medicare in 2024 that I need to know about? Yes. First of all, the standard monthly premium for Medicare Part B, which covers doctor visits and other outpatient services, will be $174.70, an increase of $9.80 from 2023. The annual deductible is going up to $240. If you have a Medicare Advantage plan, you usually have an additional monthly premium. How much depends on what plan you've chosen and where you live. Same goes for the monthly premium for any Part D prescription drug plan you have. There will also be some changes as a result of a new prescription law. Catastrophic drug coverage. If your Part D drug costs reach $8,000 in 2024, that will put you in the catastrophic phase, meaning you won't have to pay any further for prescription drugs for the rest of the year. Part D premium increase limits. From 2024 through 2029, Part D plans cannot increase their so-called base premiums more than 6% a year. But because plans' cost can vary widely, some beneficiaries could see a drop in premiums and others might have significant increases. Extra help. Eligibility for extra help, which assists people with limited incomes to afford their prescription drug cost, is being expanded. The income threshold for the program will be 150% of the federal poverty level. That's $21,870 for an individual. You have been listening to Senior Living here on Al Radio. You can listen to Al Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.alradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 this evening. I'm Chrissy Mernon saying goodbye from Al Radio.